Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. At this time, we begin the TechNet on Lime Arkham. I think this is TechNet number 1403 of the series that began in September of 1982, 29 and a half years ago. Most Sunday evenings, guys gather at this frequency, this time, to discuss their favorite subject, usually ham radio, but not necessarily. Anything of interest to a ham radio operator is appropriate for the TechNet. Person signs into the TechNet by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. So John is KC2WGB, I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. As I said before, almost any subject of interest to ham radio operators is appropriate for the net. So let's begin. Do we have any check-ins tonight? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
KC2ERR.
KC2ERR. And your name, sir? Is that Echo Romeo Romeo?
Roger that, Angel.
We got you, Angel. All right, Angel's number one. Who's number two to check in?
Time to exchange with one subject for first hour and the rest after fall.
Okay. Wes says he's got a brief subject for the first hour. Anyone else to check in, give me your call letters and name right now. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment.
N2MB, just want to check in. No traffic tonight. Good evening, Dick.
And WS2N. Paul, good evening, Dick. Space report.
Oh, we got you, Paul. We got you, Barry. Let's hope that Barry does have a question. Sometimes he does. And one more call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the net? Give me your call letters right now.
KD2CGM.
Yes.
KD2, Charlie Golf Mike. And your name, sir, is?
Yes, my name is Norman. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, Norman. Let's see now. Make sure I got the numbering right. And anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. On the input, I'm hearing KD2BBR or something, a BVR. However, maybe you don't have a PL turned on. Let me see if that's required. Stand by. Nope, I turned off my PL. That's not it. I'm hearing you on the input. I'm not hearing you on the output. Give me those call letters again, sir. It sounded like KD2BVR, something like that. Go ahead. Okay, Anthony, KD2BVR. I'm not hearing you coming through the machine. I'm hearing you on the input. Where are you located, Anthony? That explains it. He's in Dick's Hills. Okay. Is that Baker Victor Romeo, Anthony? Baker Romeo. Okay. I'll have to repeat your questions because right now you're not coming through the machine. All right, the first one was Angel. Hello, Charlie 2, Echo Romeo Romeo. What would you like to talk about tonight, Angel? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, I'm problems right now with the situation because I'm trying to run one cable to my station and two antennas, HF and 2 meter 440. So I need a duplex in the end where the radio is at, and a duplex at the end. Now my question is, is it better just to get two separate cables, or just would it be fine to get a duplex in the beginning and at the end?
I prefer redundancy, Angel. In other words, to run a separate coax cable for your HF antenna, a separate coax cable for your VHF, UHF antenna is the way I would do it. Because cables are not that expensive, and you got sort of a fallback. In other words, if any one of the cables fail, you're still on the air. I'll admit, though, that some of the modern-day rigs, which cover a whole lot of bands, and all the electronic switching takes place inside of the transceiver itself, where you have, in some cases, one single output connector that covers everything from 80 meters to 432 megacycles. In that kind of a case, it would be tempting to run one cable. Phil, I like the idea of two cables. I don't know if there is a commercial product which has a duplexing filter function where one port out of the duplexer covers your 80 through 10 meters and another connector out of the duplexer covers 2 meters and 440. I don't know if there is a product like that. It's doable. However, the duplexing filter is going to have a little bit of insertion.
I think there is such a product, but it's probably not worth the trouble.
Okay, Barry, sounds like you know something about it. How expensive? What do you think is the insertion loss? How big? Tell us what you know about that one, Barry. N2MB, K2RW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, there are several of those on the market, actually. The problem is that they're not cheap. They run as much as $100, $90, each. And the way this gentleman just explained it, he believes he needs two, one at the bottom and one at the top of the coax. I think there's one question that has to be answered. I don't know what kind of antenna he's got. He might have an antenna that covers all those frequencies. I don't know what he's using. So in that case, he would only need something at the bottom by his radio. I don't know what radio he's got also, because he might have a radio that it all comes out of one port. That's really possible. I'm using one right now that does that. So we got to answer two questions for me, and then we could go further with it. One is, does your radio have VHF and HF, I guess, coming out of one port on the back, or is it assigned to two ports on the back in 2MB?
And before we leave you, Barry, the $100 item that is a duplexing filter, how big? Is it weatherproofed if you were going to put it outside? And for $100, that's enough to turn the average guy off. Nowadays, you can buy a complete Waxon or whatever radio for $100, and you can buy an awful lot of coax cable for $100. So how big is this thing? Do you think it's weatherproofed? What brand name is it, Barry? Go ahead.
I got to look. I actually have one here. I got to look at it to get the brand name, but they're not weatherproof. So that's the other problem. He's going to have to put it into a weatherproof box. It's a big mess, I agree with you. All said and done, he's probably better off spending the money on a very low-loss cable, a couple of them, and that will solve his problem. He doesn't even need a low-loss cable probably for the HF. For the VHF, maybe. He didn't answer the question, though, whether his antenna is all band. Some of them are, you know, or if he's got two separate antennas, and the radio, whether... It is got two ports on the back for HF and VHF, or one port. This radio I'm talking to you on tonight is a little 817 Yaesu, and it actually only has one connection on the back for everything from 432 to 160 meters. So, you know, it depends on his radio. And hold on a second, I'll get the brand name. One moment.
Take your time on that one, Barry. I'll come back to you. So, Angel, what radio are you using? And I think there are very few antennas that will cover 80 meters through 432 all in one antenna. But for $100 and you still have to supply weatherproofing, sounds like a lot to go through to use the duplexing filters. It's a nice, sophisticated-sounding approach, and it gives you a pretty block diagram on a piece of paper. But to really do it, I think there's a number of disadvantages. So what radio are you using, Angel, and what kind of an antenna? KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
How is that? I'm using the A57. It's not really about buying more cable. It's just the fact that I'm running through the house. More cables is more visible. So that was the question. The next question was, if I run over 100 feet now of wire, of cable, should I change over to a different cable if I run over 100 feet?
Most of the reasonable coax cables you're likely to use for 80 through 10 meters, 100 feet is not a big problem. When it comes to 2 meters and 432, 100 feet could be a problem. For instance, a piece of RG8 cable, RG214 or RG8, has something like 4.5 dB of loss per 100 feet on 432. That's starting to get excessive. So in the case of 432, you'd like to use, for the major distance, you'd like to use something that's kind of low in loss, like hardline cable. You know, half-inch hardline, three-quarter-inch, seven-eighths-inch hardline. They got a lot lower loss, if you can afford it. RG8 will work on 432, it's just that approximately 4.5 dB of loss is kind of undesirable, if you know what I mean. Also, everybody thinks that the cable coming out of the back of the rig has to have no interruptions and go all the way up to the antenna in one straight piece. To run through the house for the short distance, you could use any diameter cable that's convenient. The loss from a cable comes from its length. So the short length in the house could transition to, with some kind of a junction connector, to a larger diameter cable outside the house where the major length is. And with some good weatherproofing techniques where one cable joins the other with a bullet adapter, if you know what I mean, a female-to-female adapter, that could give you the best bang for the dollar. Small diameter cable in the house, low-loss cable outside for the long length. So that's one of the ways to consider going. Let me, before we go over to Barry, what kind of an antenna are you using for each of those bands, Angel? KC2ERR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm using a 2 meter 440, which I have to replace because it's no good. I found out that the 2 meter is gave me a lot of high SWR, so that has to be replaced. And the HF antenna, which I had as a RS7000, I had my setup in the yard, and when I put it together between the pipe and the antenna, it scared me because it was too tall. So right now I'm going to use a wire. So I'm going to use a wire for the HF and a 2 meter 440 for the 2 meter 440. I got to get to another antenna for that. But the RS7000, I'm going to get rid of it because it's too big for my yard and I can't manage it.
Yeah, Barry and I are now seeing the fact that you do have completely separate antennas for those bands, which is what I sort of suspected. There are very few antennas that would cover 80 meter up to 432 all to grind in one antenna. The 857, I think, does have one output connector for all those bands, but I still would prefer more than one cable is the way I would go. With now what we know, let's see what Barry's got to say. N2MB, with his suggestion, K2RIW. Go ahead, Barry. We got you, Jim. Not to worry. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, real good. Yeah, if you use a wire antenna, like you just said, it probably doesn't have traps in it. That means the wire antenna is going to need an antenna tuner. So I, if you could stick with that vertical that you just mentioned, I think you'd be better off if you can. But if you can't, you're going to need an antenna tuner, a lot of other things to finish this job up. It's not going to be so simple.
Well, how about a fan dipole for the HF antennas, Barry? And then his 2 meter 440 would be the second cable to the second antenna. So he might get by with no antenna tuner with a fan dipole properly tuned. It's not a popular antenna, but I think it should be. Over to you for a comment on that one, Barry.
Yeah, I totally agree. I just didn't think of that. I think that's what Jim should be using. I think that's his name up in northern Queens up there. He just broke in a minute ago. He has something else. I guess I'll let him tell you what he's got, which would also work, but it's more expensive. The fan dipole is cheap and very, very effective, and you could make adjustments on it. and adjusting one band has very little effect on the other one. So if you're at all handy and you want to get out there and play with the antenna a little bit, that's not a bad idea. Over.
So you can see the way we're steering you here, Angel. The wire antenna, not very expensive. You can cover each one.
He can even use that thing on 2 meters if he, you know, he's probably using repeaters, so he could probably make a vertical dipole for 2 meters on that thing, and it would still work.
Now we're talking. So there's a possibility, Angel, where one single piece of cable could cover all bands. If it was a fan dipole, the fan dipole would have an 80, a 40, a 20, and a 10-meter piece of wire. The 15, you don't have to put up a separate one, because that's the third harmonic of 7 megacycles. So that piece of wire will cover that one. Now, there's nothing magic about all the wires being parallel to the ground on a fan dipole. What Barry is suggesting is that you could build a fan dipole where the 2-meter version of it has the two dipole sections purely vertical, perpendicular to the ground, and the one piece of cable will handle that. So there's a possibility there you could have an inexpensive antenna. You might not get quite as much performance, although then again, the fact that the fan dipole tends to be high up in the air can help an awful lot. So you got lots of choices there. Over to you for any final comments on this one, Angel. KC2ERR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
2AVU, comments.
AVU recognized, but Angel first, go ahead.
Roger that. I like the idea of, I think I will go with the two cables. I was told that anytime you break the cable, you're losing signal there. When you break that, any connection. I have to remeasure everything. I believe I have more than 100 feet. Thing is that if I can use a small cable in the house, or two small cables in the house, and then when I get out in the yard, I use that other, a different size, would that work out for me?
Yes, that will definitely work out for you, Angel. Lots of people are afraid to break a cable and change, from one diameter to another. They think something bad's going to happen. Weatherproofing-wise, you got to be careful. In other words, where you've broken the cable, you want to do something to make sure that the water doesn't get into that connection. But insertion loss of a cable is almost 99% due to its diameter and length. The fact that you've got an adapter from one diameter cable to another diameter cable, and everybody thinks adapters and connectors have got a whole lot of loss. They do not. The only way you get real loss at radio frequencies is with length. And the connector is only, an inch or two long. The adapter, only an inch or two long. As long as it's making good contact. There is no real loss there. Just gotta be careful with weatherproofing. It sounded like KB2AVU, Alpha Victor Uniform. If that was your call letter, then your name is Steve, but now I don't think that's going to be your call letter. ABU with your comment, go right ahead. Start off with your name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
This is Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Victor Uniform. The name is Tian Yi, Tim for short. And do you have a comment on the fan dipole and the two-band antenna? I have a Yaesu FT100 Delta, and I use a fan dipole for 10 meter and 6 meters, and also a DK7ZB dual-band Yagi for 2 and 440. It's very convenient. You don't need to have a lot of antennas, for different bands, and the fan dipole for 10 and 6 works great. Over to you, Dick. This is KD2AVU.
Very fine. Now, I'm going to call you Tim. T-I-A-N-Y-I. Doesn't sound like an Irish name. When I go to your QIZ.com, you've got a very nice picture of your antenna. And I'm guessing I'm looking at 6 meters above 2 meters. That's an unusual way. The average guy will put the 6-meter antenna down low and the higher frequency antenna up high. Are those two antennas on your picture 6 and 2 meters, or are they 2 and 432? I'm back to you, Tim. K2RIW.
That is 2 meter and 432 antennas. Both are DK7ZB design, and yeah, they're both 28 ohm design antenna. So actually, you know, I tried a different configuration, and this way works best. But it does get a lot of wind load on top, so you know, I have to use several guy wires to pin down the mat. Over to you, Dick.
Now, you said 28 ohm impedance. That's unusual. I wonder if that's what you mean, that the antennas are 28 ohms. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, that is 28 ohm impedance. And the matching sections are two parallel 75 ohm cable TV cables, and I think it's a quarter wavelength. And you solder the braid together and the sender conductor together. You know, it works as a transformer that way. I forgot what it is, but anyways, it's a DK7ZB design. You know, looks very interesting, and he also has a 12.5 ohm design. You know, instead of using 75 ohm, he uses 50 ohm in the same configuration. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, the basic Yagi antenna itself, many of the better designs, the actual driven element at the center of the dipole of the driven element comes out with numbers like 20 and 25 and 30 ohms. But then by way of a T-match, folded dipole, and other techniques, you can make the driven element any impedance you want. One of the things that's not well known about Yagis is that for the Yagi to work well, you've got a number of parasitic elements, the directors and reflectors, and as long as they're the right length, electronically length, and the right position in three-dimensional space, then the antenna will work like a charm. The driven element only has to give you a dipole-like radiation pattern and give you a good impedance match to your cable and maybe some good balancing action to your transmission line. So the driven element, you could, if you want to, take anybody's Yagi design and replace the driven element with whatever your favorite driven element and method of feeding it is, and you'll get the exact same performance. A lot of people think there's something magic about the driven element and the way it is coupled to the rest of the antenna, if you know what I mean. Okay, so I think we've given Angel some suggestions. Angel, when you finally settle on what antenna you're going to build, come back and let us know how well it works. The next person on the list was Wes, and Wes has a brief question for this portion of the net in 2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, indeed, in 2XJN. It is brief and it is easy. What is actually happening is that starting from January of 2012, people around the world have reported hearing strange sounds from the skies over the January, and it looks like the pattern is increasing. Me and John, we went through the map of these events, and it's everywhere in the world, excluding Africa. Let me drop. When you type in Google strange sounds, you're going to get about 50 pages of it. And when you go to YouTube, you're going to have hundreds of videos that will document the sounds. In Poland, mainstream, also in Canada, mainstream media pick up those news, and they simply reported it to the public. In various places in Poland, the sound was at the level of 80 dBs. Now you guys gotta remember, 110 dBs is the noise that can damage your hearing. Also, me and John, we went through the spectrum analysis to find out the frequency of those noises. And I established about 220 hertz. John has a little bit different opinion in this matter. A little bit brief information about what is happening.
It's a question or a speech?
Sir, if you're not interested in that, please let me talk. It's just the information for everybody else. It's a scientific event that is happening in here, and I want to just give you a few information about it. Sir, so, some scientists have postulated that this strange sound in the sky could be created by fracking, which is rock burst and venting of the high-pressure gases trapped in the earth. Some of them says that it's a ring of fire, that the volcanic activity has been rising. That's more or less scientific. Some of them says that meteor showers can definitely produce that, and also sound have been indication of magnetic field changes in the earth. And some of them said that it might be due to... No, I'm not going to go to that. They talk about the heart. So I would like John to refer about this subject and to Jim.
When it comes to these strange sounds that people are recording with their video cameras, Wes has put a number of those websites on a particular email, which I think has been transferred to Bernie's website. For those who want to see what we're talking about, if you go to Bernie@huntfamily.com or .org, I keep forgetting. Anyhow, go to K2YO's website, and you'll be able to find the email addresses of these YouTube videos. So I had the impression, John, that you've looked at some of these. I've looked at some of them, and they certainly are strange. It's a kind of a roaring sound that people are recording outside of their house, and 80 decibels. The way sound is recorded is that the weakest possible sound that a good set of human ears can hear, they call that 0 dB, something like minus 114. I forget what the units are. But anyhow, that's considered zero, and 80 decibels stronger than that is quite a bit of sound. It's a hell of a lot more than the sound of speech, if you know what I mean, and those recordings are picking it up very well. We're certainly not going to solve this one. It's a great big mystery, assuming that these are all realistic. Let me turn it over to John for a couple of comments on this one, then I'm going to be moving on to the next subject for now. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2ZEA.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, everyone in the net. Yeah, Dick, I did listen to them. They sound, most of the time, like alpine horns. I'm sure you've heard of those from Switzerland. I don't believe it's fracking or meteors because of the length of time they last. And that drone does change into oddity sounds, but most of the time it sounds like those alpine horns to me. So what's causing them? I have no idea, but it is an interesting subject.
Sure is. That is to say, it's one hell of a mystery. N2ZEA, I think it was, that's who you are, Glenn Zebra Echo Alpha. Wonder if you're familiar with this particular subject, Glenn. Go ahead.
Negative, not this one. I just want to get on the list for questions later on.
Okay, we've got you on the list. All right, the next person on the list was Norm, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Golf Mike. Go right ahead, Norm, with your question, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, good evening, everybody. Good evening, Dick. I had a question. It was kind of in regards to Angel's question earlier. I'm new to ham radio, and next month I'm looking to get my general license, and I set up a 2-meter, 70-centimeter antenna right now, and I'm planning on setting up a dipole. My question was, actually the dipole was going to be a fan dipole. It was going to be an alpha delta. It covered 80 to 10 meters, I believe. My question was, can I mount the dipole on the same mast that I have the 2 meter 70 centimeter antenna on, as long as it's like, say, 5 feet away?
Absolutely, Norm. It doesn't have to be as far as 5 feet away. What you're really talking about here is effective capture area of the antenna. And what your eye sees when you look at a piece of wire and what that radio wave sees, in many cases, is very different. You probably heard me with that little speech last weekend about an 80-meter dipole, 132-foot-long piece of wire the average guy makes out of copper 14-gauge household wire. And you add up the area of the wire of the dipole, it casts a shadow on the ground at high noon of about 1 square foot. But because when it resonates, a dipole has an effective area of 8,500 square feet. Your dipole that you want to put up, your fan dipole, connected to the same mast, let me drop, is going to be almost transparent at 2 meters at 432. The wire could be very close. It could be 1 or 2 feet away, the fan dipole center insulator, so to speak. And because the wire is not resonant on 2 meters or 432, it'll have very little effect. If you did an experiment where you took your fan dipole and started mounting it closer and closer to the 2 meter Yagi, and you started measuring the effect, the major effect you would see is that as the fan dipole gets super close to the elements of the 2 meter Yagi, the extra capacitance that the tips of the Yagi elements would see when they look at the wire would create a little bit of detuning. It would start tuning them to a lower frequency. So until you get close enough to get capacitive loading, there's going to be almost no interaction. And it's going to happen at something like 1 foot. So a couple of feet of spacing is more than enough. Now, if you've got a high enough tower and there's enough mast space and tower space that you're going to mount it 5 feet away for mechanical convenience, that would be great. But if you want to mount it closer, I think you can do it. And by the same token, let me drop. The 2 meter Yagi, a good, let's say a 5 element Yagi on 2 meters, it's got an effective capture area of something in the vicinity of 10 foot diameter circle. So if you're mounting a pair of 2 meter Yagis on the same mast, it'd be nice to mount them something like 8 feet or more apart so that the areas don't overlap. However, the 432 Yagi and the 2 meter Yagi each have their areas only on that frequency. You could mount the 432 Yagi 1.5 feet above the 2 meter Yagi, and neither one of them would interfere with the other. Ain't that crazy? You'd be amazed how close you can mount things when they're on different frequencies before they interact with each other. There's a lot of experiment you can do along those lines, and you'd be amazed the good results that almost everybody has found on that one, Norm. KD2CGM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much. That'll save a lot of trouble being able to mount it on the same mast. One more question, if you had time. I just had a question on coax. There's so many different types of coax out there, and you were saying before that usually you have to get to at least 100 feet before you notice a loss. What is the best all-around cable, if there is one, to use?
Norm, if I could afford it, every one of my antennas would be fed with a piece of Andrew Heliac 1.625 inch diameter. I'm guessing it's about a pound per foot, and it's probably $5 per foot. So if money was no object, and weight and size and beauty is no object, but that's what I would feed all my antennas with. And oh, by the way, on 432, that's got a loss of, a couple of tenths of a dB per 100 feet. We got to be practical. Every real installation, you're not going to use 1.625 inch diameter. It looks like a piece of garden hose, 2 or 3 times normal diameter, really big stuff. The foam-filled cables have much lower loss. That's the good news. But the flexible foam-filled cables, it's hard to believe that the outer black polyvinyl jacket is a very good weather seal. It is not a hermetic seal. So unless there's some kind of an inner metal layer of some kind, the moisture slowly migrates through the outer polyvinyl chloride jacket, slowly gets into the foam, and at UHF, VHF frequencies, the foam cables, although they start off lower in loss, they start climbing in loss a year or two or 3 years down range. So the low loss cables, foam filled, go for hard line, not flexible. The flexible cables don't use great big long lengths of them, so the best approach is a hard line cable going up the tower for the major length, then flip over to a flexible piece of cable that's got a solid jacket like polyethylene, RG8 cable, to go around the rotator. And that doesn't suck up water, as long as you've got a good sealing on the connectors. The foam-filled cables in that location could give you trouble. What's the best combination? Yeah, the next question, what you're really asking, as I see it, Norm, is you'd like to know what's the best combination of dollars, size, weight, longevity, and so on with cable. The best cable for the dollar is a 70-ohm hard line that's used by the cable TV companies. You go to their warehouse, their stockyard, and you can get hundreds of feet of the stuff free of charge once you establish a good relationship with the guy that runs the stockyard, because they buy it in 5,000-foot reels, and when there's 100 or 200-foot left on the end of the reel, they don't start another run down the block because they'd have to put in a splice. So they bring the reel back to the stockyard, and they got lots of these reels sitting around with 100 or 200 feet on it. And so quite often you can get that for free. A little bit of a problem to put the right kind of a connector on the end, and people worry themselves crazy about the fact that a 70-ohm cable is not an impedance match for a 50-ohm system. Well, that's only a 1.5 standing wave ratio. The cable is lower in loss than anything you're going to get. And in fact, you're listening to my transmission through a piece of 70-ohm cable right now, 120-foot length of it, roughly. So that gives you the best bang for the dollar. And that hardline cable, the 70-ohm stuff used by the cable company, you could directly bury it in the ground for the next 20 years, run it underwater or whatever. Really good stuff. But it's not flexible. And as I said, the connectors are a bit of a problem. So it's going to take visiting flea markets and talking to your friends and whatever to find out what's the best cable for you. There's no one great solution there, as you can tell. And when you do select a particular cable and you find out how well it's working, come back and let us know about it, Norm. KD2, yeah, CGM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2APG.
The question on the topic.
Okay, I heard that N2APG. Dave first, and then I have another subject on that. Dave first. Go ahead, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW.
Yeah, hi, Dick. N2APG, Dave and Matt Siegler. While we're on the topic of coaxial cables, you always mention the degradation of cables, and the moisture gets in there and stuff like that. Is there a... when the cable degrades, is there a limit on the degradation? Has anybody done any tests? If you leave a piece of cable up there for 100 years, does the loss get to a certain point and level off? What's the worst case scenario?
I'm a little bit worried, Dave, that the cable will continue to degrade as time goes on. I see evidence of that. I've had some what used to be considered very high quality cable in the old days, FM8, made by the ITT company, and I used it for all of my phasing harness on 432. It continuously increased in insertion loss due to water suck up over the 7 or 8 years that I had it up there until Hurricane Gloria brought that particular antenna down for me. So does it level off? Even if it did level off, in my particular case, the insertion loss of the cable more than tripled because of water absorption. So if there isn't some kind of a metal hermetic seal between that foam and the outside world, somewhere under the cable, under the braid or whatever, or an outer hard line jacket, if there isn't a real metal encasement for your foam cable, I think foam flexible cables are quite a bit of a problem. That's my opinion on that one. There was another person who wanted to make a comment. What was his call letters? Please give it to me again. K2RIW listening.
AK1NS, Dave.
Go right ahead, Dave. We're hearing you very well over that sound.
Okay, just a quick question on topic. You're hanging those dipoles, whether it's fan or even a G5RP. Are you better off using a fiberglass mast to reduce any kind of coupling to a metal or steel mast? That's the question.
I think the answer is no, Dave. No problem. If you're talking about a horizontally polarized antenna, fan dipole, regular dipole, Yagi, whatever, the horizontal polarized antenna does not see the vertical mast. Oh, if you made the mast a foot and a half in diameter, it would start giving you some blockage, but we're not likely to do that. So as long as your metal of your mast is cross-polarized, it is not a problem. It's not there at all. If you were vertically polarizing the antenna, and now you want to put it on a fiberglass mast, at first that sounds like a good idea, but where's the transmission line going? If you're running the transmission line up that fiberglass mast, and then over along the boom and out to the driven element, you still got a vertically polarized metallic object in the vicinity of this vertically polarized Yagi antenna. You could, and by the way, when you do mount a vertically polarized Yagi on a vertical metallic mast, your common sense would lead you to believe the mast is the same polarization, it's going to cast a great big shadow and stop the operation. The mast is a very small area compared to the radio area of that Yagi. What the mast does is that it's nearby metallic object to the nearest directors, and the capacitive loading of the tips of those directors looking at the mast makes them get tuned to a slightly lower frequency. If you're a really smart guy, you could take a vertically polarized Yagi, mount it directly on your vertical metallic mast, retune by shortening slightly those two nearest directors, and you'll come back to 95% of the performance. The other approach would be the real belt and suspenders approach, would be to say that, hey, I'm going to use a pair of vertically polarized Yagis, so I'll put them on a T-bar. In other words, there'll be a horizontal bar coming off the mast. If I'm going to use 8 feet of spacing, it'll be 4 feet to the right, 4 feet to the left off the mast, and at the end of that horizontal bar, I'll mount my vertically polarized Yagis. Now you get the best of both worlds. Two Yagis, not very much mast space used up, and no nearby co-polarized metallic objects. The slight disadvantage of that kind of an antenna is that when you got two antennas side by side and you rotate it in azimuth mechanically, the antenna pattern becomes a little more narrow in the main lobe. What you think is the side lobe of the Yagi is really the side lobe of the array, and you get a slightly stronger side lobe. But those side lobes and the nulls in between them can be a real handy thing when you're trying to tune out a guy that's giving you some jamming in a particular direction. So I wonder if some of that made some sense, Dave. You can talk over top of this guy. Hey, K1NS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dick. I had a question. The G5RV has a lateral line coming down 15, 20 feet, depending on the model. And I thought the ideal situation is to keep that as far away from metallic objects as possible, but I believe I'm going to go for the Alpha Delta fan dipole myself now. There you go. Thanks again.
Yeah, a number of guys have run into some problems with the G5RV where it tends to give them a rather high standing wave ratio on 10 meters, and an antenna tuner is required. The most popular version of the G5RV does have some open wire lines on portions of it, and yes, the open wire line, you don't want to lay it near metal, otherwise you disturb its impedance pretty badly. And various versions of the G5RV don't have that open wire line. Maybe those are the versions that have more problem with tuning the 10-meter version. But I think a fan dipole has an awful lot going for it. And even if you mount it vertically polarized, horizontally polarized, there's lots of ways of going on that one. Okay, I think we've almost answered Norm's question. Let me check back with Norm to be sure. Back to you, Norm, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. Yeah, you answered my question. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay, the next person on our list was Anthony. Kilo Delta 2, I think it's Bravo, Bravo.
I think there was that young kid up north also. I think you might be passing over him.
No, Anthony was next, and then Jim was after that. So that was the order in which they signed in. Anthony, Kilo Delta 2, Bravo, Bravo, Romeo, I think it is. K2RW, go ahead, Anthony. Okay, for those who are not hearing Anthony, because I'm hearing him very well, he's in my town, but he's not coming through the repeater. He wants to put a dipole in the attic, and will that work? And the answer is reasonably well. A dipole out in air, you know exactly how long to make it hit resonance. You bring that dipole into the attic, and now you've got the wiring of the house, you've got the nearby capacitive loading of the rafters and the joists and the, rafters, you know what I mean, all the stuff in the house. And so to get the dipole to come back to resonance, to shorten it up because of the local capacitive loading, it's a little bit of a pain, but you can do that. The dipole outside, suspended by a tree up there with a slingshot or a bow and arrow, getting the support mechanism up nice and high, the extra altitude will give you more performance outdoors. On HF frequencies, the roof is reasonably transparent. It'll work. The antenna being that close to all the other appliances in the house could give you a little bit of grief. There are guys who have got a fluorescent light in the kitchen that gets bright when they press down the key on 40 meters, or the television set gets a little bit more interference. So the antenna inside the house, it's a nice idea to make sure that the neighbors don't see the antenna, and maybe you've got the zoning code that makes life a little bit difficult. So putting the antenna inside the house, it has certain advantages, but there are certain disadvantages. It'll work, but you may have to do a little bit more fiddling, and you may have to do some other protection of your appliances in the house, because it is going to be kind of close to them, and they're going to start getting a reasonably strong signal. Over to you, Anthony, 82 Baker Romeo, K2RIW. I'll be hearing him on the input, even though you guys are not hearing him on the output. Go ahead, Anthony. Okay, and as you build that antenna and find out what's required to retune it and whatever, come back and let us know about that, Anthony. And out of curiosity, you and I live in the same town. Any idea how far you are from me, Anthony? Go ahead. Okay, he's fairly sure he's within a mile of me. And yeah, Fred's a good guy. So we'll be talking later, Anthony. Okay, the next guy on the list is Jim, KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee. And which one of the four experiments that you're running in parallel are you going to talk about tonight, Jim? You got it, Jim. K2RIW.
Yeah, 2RY with a question. I'd like to get on the list.
Joe's on the list, but Jim, KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee, go right ahead.
Hi, Dick. I have two questions today. One I just was looking at earlier, a couple minutes ago. I just put up an antenna, a dipole, and I trimmed. It was originally a G5RV Junior, but I didn't have a tuner, so I just trimmed it for 20 meters. I trimmed it really accurately. My dad put it up on the house, laying against the side of the house. I set it up, we set it up perfectly. So I get in the house and I connect it to my transceiver that I got from Hal. And I turn it on and I switch it to 20 meters and I hear nothing. So I switch around the band a little bit and I hear some signals on 40 meters. And I'm just wondering what's going on there, because I trimmed the dipole for 20 meters and I'm hearing stuff on 40 meters and not 20 meters.
It may be time to start doing some simple ohmmeter tests, Jim, because when the band is in reasonably good shape, 40 meters, 20 meters, any of these bands, and if the receiver is working reasonably well, in the shack you can take a clip lead with some kind of a sharp pointy object on the end of it, stick it into the center conductor of the output connector, of the input connector on your receiver, and with just a couple of feet of wire in the shack, you'll hear guys on those bands. It doesn't require a carefully tuned antenna for the receiver to work. You can't transmit through that. So if you've got real connection to a real piece of wire and the receiver's really working, a random length of wire will give you reception. So when when you're going through your transmission line to that antenna that you've carefully tuned, and by carefully tuning you mean you measure to the nearest 16th of an inch mechanically. And so what you do with mechanical tuning of an antenna and what its electronic tuning is doing is a little bit different. But that's a minor factor. That's not what's causing it here. The fact that you're not hearing signals through that antenna tells me that there's a complete open circuit or short circuit somewhere. By way of your ohm meter, the first test would be an ohm meter in the shack between center conductor and shield to make sure you're not measuring zero ohms because there's a short circuit at one end. That's if the antenna was supposed to be an open circuit, and so on. And then there's various other ways. So I think you've got a complete short circuit or a complete mechanical disconnect somewhere, because to get no reception, unless the band is dead, that can't happen. And you can always double check this by unconnecting the coax cable on the back of the receiver. Let me drop. And simply connecting a random hunk of wire in the shack, and you'll be hearing signals. So you can see why I'm a little bit suspicious here, Jim. And it's a good troubleshooting procedure you're about to go through. It's an educational process. KD2BHY, K2RIW. You can talk over him, Jim.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Dick. It was just a little confusing, and I thought I'd ask you, and I said, I'm going to see if I can figure out what's wrong. But I think there's a bad connection from the coax to the coax that leads down from the antenna. I think there's a little bit of water damage there. I'll definitely see what I can do there. And I had another question, just a quick one. I at a yard sale, I bought this $10 little Olympia battery-powered TV, and I already had one of those. So I decided that I would part one of them since I had two of them. And while parting one, I found in the back of it, there was a vacuum tube that looked to be connected directly to the screen. Looked like the screen kind of went into the vacuum tube. Now, I'm not exactly sure if it's a vacuum tube or not, but if it is, could I use it to maybe build a receiver or transmitter or use it? Or is it even a vacuum tube?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I guess the best you could do, if you've got a camera and a way of sending that picture to us, send us a picture of the thing that you're describing. I'm having trouble picturing a screen that looks like a vacuum tube, and can you really use it for a transmitter or receiver?
Dick, you might be talking about the neck of the CRT.
Okay. Give us a little bit more of a description, Jim. So maybe I didn't catch it the first time around. So give us a description of the thing you're describing. You got it, Jim.
Yeah, it's a little bit hard to explain here, but I'll try. The back of the screen, when you open up the TV, looks like a pyramid, as in there's a... When you look behind the screen, there's a pyramid, and there's a metal pyramid attached to the screen. On top of that little metal pyramid on the back of the screen, there is something that looks like, to me, a vacuum tube. And I tried to take it out, but it looks like it goes right in. If you need a little better description, I'll try again.
He's talking about a picture tube, Dick, I'm sure of it. Is he talking about yolk?
It does sound like some of the early cathode ray tubes did have a complete metal back. The whole back of the tube was metallic, or at least a major portion of it was.
Yeah, please tell him about the high voltage in that thing, too.
Yeah. So you got to be careful. Many of these older cathode ray tubes did have a cone-shaped object made out of metal that was the back of the tube. The portion you think would be glass became metal. And then the neck of the tube stuck out from beyond that. And yes, there's a high-voltage connector plugged into that. And in most cases, there's something like 20,000 volts on that. So it doesn't have enough current to give you complete electrocution, but it'll make you damn unhappy. So you got to be careful with these older television sets because everything nowadays is solid state and people don't have as much experience with the high voltage of a television set. I think the next best thing you can do, Jim, is mail us a picture of what you're looking at. But that pyramid-shaped object, I don't think you can use it as an antenna. I don't think you can use it other than as a television set, Jim. Back you, Jim. K2LIW.
Well, I'm not sure, but you might be slightly misunderstanding here. I'm not sure, though. Imagine a vacuum tube, and the connection of the vacuum tube is sticking upright. And at the part where there should be, where there would be glass, there's about a 4-inch by 4-inch pyramid that just goes down. I'm not sure if you were picturing that or not, but just to double check here.
Yeah, we're all going to have a little bit of trouble with this until you send us a picture. The pyramid, I think you're saying now, the wide part of the pyramid is down and the sharp point is up, and that's connected to one of the things that looks like a vacuum tube. Run that by again, Jim.
I'm not sure. I'll definitely send you a picture if I can tonight, but if I cannot tomorrow, I'll definitely send you a picture. I think I have your email. Yeah, I'll definitely send you one. It's kind of hard to explain, but once you see it, you'll understand.
Okay. You've got a tough one there, Jim. You stumped us on this one.
A point for Jim.
Go ahead, John.
Jim, when you take the photograph, cut out a little paper arrow and point exactly to the item you're speaking about, and this way we'll be able to tell.
Okay, John, I'll definitely do that. Back to next.
Okay, Jim, good luck with that project. Joe, you're next on the list. Mr. RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. K2RIW, WRYY.
Vehicle on Palisades Parkway, southbound at exit 12. This is a Pomona. Traffic back up to exit 13. The Summit Getaway report brought to you by Fairway Market. Come to the police
station. Analog stations. Because apparently Canadian TV stations, at least some I've received recently, are still broadcasting in the analog function.
Yeah, I think you left me a phone message that for the first time in a long time, you're seeing Canadian stations. And I'm amazed that Canada might be still transmitting analog television, NTSC-type television, as opposed to digital. I'm kind of amazed that they didn't go over to digital. I imagine if Eric was on frequency, KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, he could bring us up to speed on that. So I guess it was earlier this week, and was that for only one day that you were hearing these Canadian broadcast stations? And you're one of the few guys that still got an analog television. Most of us have given up the analog television for digital. Thank you for some further words on this, Joe. To V2RYY, K2RIW.
Oh, no, I heard them several times during one particular week, the early part of last week, very early part, during the mid part and towards the later part of the week, like Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. And they seem to be coming on around, say, 7 o'clock, 6:30, 7 o'clock, till about 8:30, 9 o'clock. And after the sun out here pretty much sets the evening, they pretty much disappeared. I was getting them at a bearing of about 030 degrees, about the best signal strength is 040 degrees. I was getting TV stations on channel 2, 3, and 4. I was getting multiple stations. And I definitely know it was Canada because one of the stations on channel 2 was speaking French Canadian. The other one was Entertainment Tonight Space Canada underneath it. But I know I was looking at Canadian stations. I was very surprised myself to actually see analog stuff coming here in that direction. But yes, I still own an analog TV set. The regular TV set connected to my converter. I just turned the converter off to see what else is out there besides digital TV. Back to you.
Boy, that's a fun project. You're on the south shore of Long Island. So you're getting those signals across Long Island, across the Long Island Sound, up through New England, and then into Canada. We have had some very nice sporadic E and other kinds of long-range VHF propagation over the last couple of weeks. As you know, last weekend, Barry in 2MB was telling us about his 6-meter contacts with Hawaii around 5,500 miles away, which I'm guessing is at least triple and maybe four hops to get there. During this week, late one night, I woke up and I heard on this particular repeater, I heard my buddy WA1ZVH, Harold, who's on the Massachusetts-Vermont border, heard him check into this repeater. He just turned on the right PL tone, and he lit up this one as well as and not lighting up all of the other 2585 repeaters. And so he and I had a QSO for three quarters of an hour or so. And the thing that Barry in 2MB would be interested in, that really interested me, is that during this conversation I had with